All right, now, we left off last week getting into the nature and problem of aggregate profit, and I explained how profits at the macro level are determined by different factors than at the micro level and have a different significance.
We're in supplement five, Professor?
Yes.
Yeah, we're in supplement, still in supplement five. All right, well, what I want to begin with tonight is point D under one, namely the problem of aggregate profit, productive expenditure, and the generation of equivalent sales revenues and costs. And what I mean by that is productive expenditure is related to profit in two ways. Productive expenditure generates sales revenues that are just about perfectly equivalent to itself, or at least it's reasonable to assume that. In the economy as a whole, total productive expenditure will generate sales revenues equal to itself. Now, why? Well, what are the two components of productive expenditure? What are the two main components? Well, net investment is the result of the subtraction from productive expenditure of business costs. What's included in productive expenditure? The expenditure for capital goods.
Labor.
And the demand for labor, the expenditure for labor. Payrolls and the spending to buy capital goods. Now, the spending to buy capital goods, that's all the goods and services business firms buy from other business firms. It includes all of the goods they buy at wholesale, all of the materials they buy, all of the components, all of the semi-manufacturers, all of the supplies, and all of the things they buy from other businesses on account, all the machinery they buy from other businesses, all the tools, all the construction materials, all the rentals of construction equipment. So what are those outlays from the perspective of the firms on whom the outlays are made? When General Motors buys steel from U.S. Steel, what is that expenditure from the perspective of U.S. Steel? It's sales revenue. Can you think of any outlay for a newly produced good or service by one business that is not the sales revenue of another business? What about the government? Excuse me?
Is that an example where it would not be government?
Well, are you assuming that business firms are buying newly produced goods and services from the government? Well, when a building inspector comes by, are you legally paying him anything to begin with?
Yeah. You have to pay him to inspect the house. You won't get a building permit.
Oh, there is a fee?
There's a fee, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, then this would be an outlay. It's not for a newly produced good or service, but it would be in the nature of a tax payment, essentially. All right. So this would be a kind of payment that wouldn't be a sales revenue, but is it the purchase of a good or service, a newly produced good or service, from any other business firm? No.
No,
I
think so.
All right. Well, all of these productive expenditures for goods at wholesale, for machinery, materials, components, supplies, construction materials, all of these productive expenditures that, insofar as they represent the demand for capital goods, are sales revenues to the sellers of those capital goods. All of the purchases of newly produced capital goods constitute sales revenues to the sellers of those capital goods. All right, what do the wage earners do with the wages they receive?
Purchase.
Okay, they can be assumed reasonably to consume their wages. Even when they save much, if or sometimes all of their savings would show up as a demand for consumers' goods, to the extent that it would finance the purchase of new homes. If their savings are financing the purchase of new homes, new automobiles, and so forth, even their savings show up as a demand for consumers' goods. All right, well, in this way, we can take the payment of wages as indirectly showing up in receipts from the sale of consumers' goods when the wage earners consume their wages. All right, so far, what relationship do we have between productive expenditure in the economy and sales revenues in the economy?
There's a positive relationship there?
Well, the productive expenditure generates virtually equal sales revenues. It generates sales revenues equal to itself. One part of productive expenditure, that part which is the demand for capital goods, is one huge part of sales revenues, the receipts from the sale of capital goods. And then the other remaining part of productive expenditure, the demand for labor, payrolls, that makes possible the demand for consumers' goods by the wage earners. So directly or indirectly, productive expenditure shows up as sales revenues equal to itself. Now, what connection is there between productive expenditure and costs in the economy as a whole? What connection is there between the productive expenditure of any one firm and its costs? Pardon me? Well, can you say any more than that? Suppose we have, here's a firm, it spent $1 million buying various means of production. What is going to follow from that $1 million in connection with the costs the firm will show? What will follow in connection with the costs the firm will show?
Yeah? When the cost of that?
Well, if you spend $1 million to buy means of production, doesn't that mean, pardon me?
There'll be a depreciation cost associated.
Yes?
If you spend $1 million, it costs you $1 million, so it should be.
Well, you're going to have costs of $1 million. And they'll show up sooner or later in your income statements. Where do the costs in income statements come from?
Depreciation.
Pardon me?
Depreciation.
Well, there's cost of goods sold, there's depreciation, but where do those numbers come from? What gives rise to depreciation?
Previous capital expenditures.
Okay, there were previous expenditures to buy the assets being depreciated, right? And where does cost of goods sold come from?
Inventory.
Well, where did the inventory come from?
Production.
Previous purchases, and previous purchases of what was produced, but all of the costs derive from prior outlays of money. The costs are the reflection of prior outlays of money. It's just a question of the timing. Every dollar of productive expenditure will show up as a dollar of cost, not necessarily at the moment it's made, but sooner or later. There are differences. There are some productive expenditures which show up as cost instantaneously. That is, if you had an income statement closing 1 second after this productive expenditure were made, there are productive expenditures that would appear in that income statement. What sorts of productive expenditures would that apply to? Pardon me?
Wages.
Well, what about the wages of people installing machines, or the wages of people assembling automobiles? Are they expensed immediately?
No. Not until it's sold.
No, they're debited into inventory or work in progress. So there are some significant productive expenditures that are expensed. And what typical category would they occupy in an income statement?
General and marketing.
Selling, general, and administrative expenses. Outlays coming under the heading of selling, general, and administrative expenses, they're the kind of outlays such that if you had an income statement closing 1 second after these outlays were made, they'd appear in it as a current cost. But then you have other types of outlays, for plant and equipment. How do they get connected to cost?
Depreciation.
Via depreciation. Those assets are depreciated and the outlays show up as costs gradually over the life, over the depreciable life of the asset. And what about outlays on account of inventory or work in progress? They show up as costs only in costs of goods sold. So there are these two very significant time lags between productive expenditures and their showing up as cost, but sooner or later they all do show up as costs. Now, what would happen, imagine just for a moment, that we assumed that all productive expenditures had the character of expensed expenditures, that they all had the character of selling, general, and administrative expenses. Just suppose that for the moment. So that whatever productive expenditures were made in any given accounting period, those productive expenditures would show up as costs in that same accounting period. What would be implied at the level of the economy as a whole as between sales revenues and costs as far as productive expenditure was concerned?
Equal balance?
They would be equal. They would be equal. Productive expenditure generates sales revenues equal to itself, and if the productive expenditures were all deducted immediately as costs, well then we'd have costs equal to those same productive expenditures. And if costs and sales revenues were both equal to productive expenditure, what would be implied about profit?
Zero.
They would be zero. We wouldn't have any profit. So this raises a very important concern. How are we going to account for the existence of an economy-wide aggregate profit? Because imagine if the only element present were productive expenditure and it were generating sales revenues and costs equal to itself, that would imply that profit in the aggregate would be zero, which would be an extremely uncomfortable situation, to say the least. So we need to embark upon a search for what is it that makes it possible for sales revenues in the economy as a whole regularly and consistently to exceed costs in the economy as a whole. This is really a very vital question. Now, this relationship between productive expenditure, sales revenues, and costs, that's a very significant one. And we have to work around that in attempting to explain aggregate profit. And let's see just how we could start to do that. There is a factor that can explain an economy-wide aggregate profit, even if it were the case that the only source of sales revenues in the whole economy were productive expenditure. And even if the productive expenditures were all going to show up in as costs in a relatively short period of time. This wouldn't do the trick if the productive expenditures were going to be deducted immediately as costs. But suppose we had a situation where the productive expenditures of any given period will show up as costs, if not in that period, in the next period. So we'll have a one-period lag between the making of productive expenditures and their appearance as costs. For example, that the productive expenditures made today will show up as costs 1 year from today. And, you know, these diagrams we were working with in connection with capital accumulation, we broke them up into a succession of years. We had year one, year two, etc. Well, imagine for the moment that productive expenditures all took place on the first day of the year. And the resulting product was sold on the first day of next year. And that's when the costs would show up. The costs reflecting the productive expenditures of January 1st of year one would show up as costs in January 1st of year two. So we have a one-year lag. Now, even imagine that the only source of sales revenues in the economy were productive expenditure. Imagine we have 1,000 of productive expenditure, we have 1,000 of sales revenues. Today's 1,000 of productive expenditure will show up as 1,000 of costs 1 year from today. Well, what would make possible an aggregate profit in those circumstances? Pardon me?
Various levels of spending.
Could you elaborate various levels of spending? What if spending fell from 1,000 to 900?
Then the profit would go up in the following period.
Well, what about this period? We've spent 1,000 and we're selling goods not for 1,000, which would give us zero profit, but 900. So if we have costs of 1,000, what would that do to us?
We
have a loss of 100, but we want to find how we might have a profit of something. And you said you referred to variability. So in which direction would things have to be variable?
Opposite of what you just stated.
Or opposite of what you just stated. Okay. If the sales revenues grew, if productive expenditure in year two were larger than in year one, imagine in year one, productive expenditure is 1,000 and sales revenues are 1,000. In year two, productive expenditure will be, let's imagine, 1,050. And what sales revenues would 1,050 of productive expenditure generate? In year two, we now have 1,050 of productive expenditure. What sales revenues should we expect that to generate?
1,050.
And if it's last year's productive expenditure of 1,000, that's going to show up as the cost now, well, then we'd have 50 of profit. Now, next year, how much would show up as cost? 1,050 would show up as cost next year. What would we need to have an aggregate profit next year?
1,050.
We'd have to have what?
More than 1,050.
Yeah, the productive expenditure greater than 1,050, maybe 11-something. Well, the point is that even with a very minimal lag between productive expenditure and their appearance as costs, even if productive expenditure were the only source of sales revenues in the economy, you could still have an economy-wide aggregate profit based simply on whatever continuing growth there was in productive expenditure. Because the way it would work is the productive expenditure of year one would be the costs of year two, and the productive expenditure of year two, to the extent it was greater than that of year one, would give you sales revenues in year two greater than the costs showing up in year two. The basis of profit would be simply the growth in productive expenditure from year to year. Let me point out that to some extent, this regular growth in productive expenditure and sales revenues, this is a significant factor in the economy-wide aggregate amount of profit and the resulting economy-wide average rate of profit. And this doesn't depend on any special assumptions such as we've been making. Just think, for example, business firms are making outlays of money, and these outlays of money made at any given point in time, they're going to show up as costs sooner or later, right? And imagine we have a firm back in 1980 that was spending some money for a new plant and equipment. Now, when are those outlays showing up in income statements as costs? Assume that the plant and equipment in question had a useful life of 25 years. Well, they would be showing up as cost over a 25-year period. Now, on a straight-line depreciation basis, that would mean 4% of the outlays per year from 1980 down to this current year where those outlays would end. All right, now, does it make any difference to how much profit is earned on those outlays? What has been happening over the years to the volume of spending in the economy? Well, we know it has been going up, but the question is, what difference does the increase in spending make to the profit made on the outlays of any given prior year, so long as those outlays are still showing up as costs today?
Increases the overall profit.
Mustn't it increase the profit? Just think, you have an outlay, let's assume, of 100 in 1980, and we're depreciating it 4% a year over 25 years. So you have four of cost showing up in each year for the next 25 years. All right, now, the profit that is made in connection with that outlay of four, that's going to depend on the sales revenues you're taking in connection with the use of that asset. And what should we expect to be true of these sales revenues in connection with the overall level of sales revenues in the economy?
Greater than four.
Well, won't it tend to be the greater, the more sales revenues are rising? The more productive expenditure and sales revenues are rising from one year to the next. Won't that be building in some positive, significant element in the profit margin?
Sure.
It would have to in the nature of the case. Now, what is it that is required to bring about any kind of systematic increase in economy-wide productive expenditure and sales revenues? What is the essential foundation that makes that possible?
Increase in demand.
Well, what makes possible the increase in demand? Yes? Yes?
Increase supply.
An increase in the supply of goods, more production? Mr. Davis is saying an increase in the money supply. You're saying an increase in the supply of goods. Would you like to explain why you say the increase in the money supply?
Well, I think with an increase in the money supply, automatically there's going to be an increase in what happens with that money. We're going to invest more with that money.
Yeah. The first major proposition we tried to establish in the course was the quantity theory of money. And its substance is the amount of money that is spent depends primarily on the amount of money that exists. Well, now, imagine we had the same money supply today as we had in 1980. Should we expect that it would have been any sustained significant growth in spending from year to year?
No.
No, we might very well have the same level of spending today as we had in 1980. And if that were the case, then we wouldn't have this factor at work. Of the sales revenues rising relative to the prior outlays and building in a profit margin. Yes, Mr. Wright.
Isn't it dependent on productivity, though? Because the real value of money, the real wage, as we discussed real wages, you might have more money in the economic system, but its value, its actual value, could be less than it was in 1980.
Okay, now.
Be able to purchase less.
Okay, that's very true. That's a very good observation and question. And let's turn to that. Let's say if we had had, you see, there are two questions to address. Mr. Wright's question pertains to the real rate of profit, which is a very vital issue. What we would mean by a real rate of profit is you start out, you have a certain capital, you make hopefully some kind of profit or interest on that capital. But then there's the question, what is the buying power of your new increased capital that reflects the addition of whatever profit and interest you've made to your original capital? What is the buying power of that new, larger money capital compared to the buying power of the earlier original capital?
Yes.
Well, it'll depend. Let's deal with this question. Suppose you start out at the beginning of the year, you have a capital in terms of money of 100. And you succeed over the course of the year in earning 5 of profit or interest. And so now, at least before you pay taxes, for a moment you have 105. Well, in nominal terms, strictly in terms of dollars, what's your rate of profit?
5%.
Okay, that's the nominal rate of profit. The nominal rate of profit is the rate of profit calculated simply in terms of how much money profit do you make divided by how much money capital you started with. But then there's the question of what is your actual real gain? Because suppose it were the case that over this 1 year interval, prices had risen 5%. Well, then what would be your real profit?
Zero.
You'd have a zero real profit. And so you might have 5% nominal profit, but a zero real profit. And you could actually end up worse off, because suppose the government doesn't make the distinction, which it doesn't, and you have to pay income tax on the nominal profit. So suppose you have to pay 2 out of the 5, and that leaves you with 3. So now you have 103 of capital for a moment, and prices are 5% higher. Well, what's the buying power of 103 at prices 5% higher compared to the buying power of 100 before prices had risen? Your buying power is less. It's reduced in the amount of 103 over 105. Your buying power would be approximately 2% less. You'd have actually lost. And this happens routinely in periods of inflation. The nominal rate of profit might be high, but the real rate of profit might actually be negative, especially after taxes. The after-tax real rate of profit can easily be negative. Okay, well, there are two issues to deal with here. There's the nominal rate of profit and the real rate of profit. And what we're primarily concerned with, our central concern, is the nominal rate of profit. Not that that's sufficient. We also need to attend to the real rate of profit. But we're out at the moment to explain the nominal rate of profit, because you'd have a problem with it if it were the case that a productive expenditure was the only source of sales revenues, and costs equaled productive expenditure, and at the same time, productive expenditure didn't grow. If we had productive expenditure as a constant, and costs equal to it, and sales revenues equal to it, we'd have a pretty serious problem of zero nominal profit. Now, it could conceivably be, with the same volume of productive expenditure and sales revenues, suppose production were growing. And so we have somewhat more production coming to market from one year to the next. What would be implied if we had the same sales revenues, same spending to buy the products?
No profit.
Pardon me?
No profit.
Well, is that the result of the increase in production?
Pardon
me?
You'd have more.
Well, we could have a real profit. What would be happening to prices? Prices would fall. So now, suppose you started the year with 100, you finished the year with 100, you have no nominal profit, but if prices at the end of the year are 2% lower than they were at the beginning, what is your real situation? I'm hearing loss and gain. Mr. Taylor, you say you've lost?
You said if what was reduced, if prices went down?
Yeah, because production went up, say production went up 2%, but the 2% greater output had to be sold for the same amount of sales revenues. And so that would only be possible if prices went down correspondingly. That would be on the order of 2%.
Okay.
Then
you would be ahead if prices went down to your real profit, because you can buy more.
Right. You'd have a real profit. You'd have a real profit of 2%. You'd have a nominal profit of 0, right, but a real profit of 2%. And this should give us an indication of something, and that is that to the extent that production and supply increase, that is a factor that operates to add to the real rate of profit. The increase in production and supply is operating to add to the real rate of profit. The increase in money and spending is operating to add to what?
The nominal.
The nominal rate of profit. The nominal rate of profit. Now, suppose it were the case that we had some kind of continuing systematic growth factor. The volume of productive spending, let's say, was growing at some modest compound annual rate, perhaps 2% a year. What effect should we expect that to have on the nominal rate of profit? If the quantity of money and volume of spending are growing on the order of 2% a year, so that sales revenues this year will be 2% larger in the aggregate than they were last year. Pardon me?
We would expect nominal to increase by 50.
Yeah, we'd expect, I think we would expect that there should be an addition to the nominal rate of profit on the order of 2%. We should have a 2% nominal rate of profit. Now, what would be required in order for that 2% nominal rate of profit also to be a 2% real rate of profit?
Increase production.
If we had correspondingly increased production and supply, if production and supply also rose 2%, so here we are, we have 2% more spending, we have 2% more goods and services for the extra spending to buy, what would that imply about prices?
Remain the same.
Prices should remain the same. We have 1.02 in the numerator and 1.02 in the denominator, and so the quotient should be the same. Well, notice, if we have, to the extent that we have an increase in production and supply, that gives us an increase in the real rate of profit. To the extent we have an increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending, that gives us an increase in the nominal rate of profit. And insofar as the two go along side by side, well, the extra nominal rate of profit will mean also an extra real rate of profit. Now, where there would be this kind of happy coincidence of the two being more or less in sync, what kind of monetary system do you think that that would take place under? I would think a gold standard. Why a gold standard?
Because the money supply increases very little year over year.
Okay, the money supply increases very modestly. There is some increase. Under a gold standard, there is some increase in the money supply, not a huge increase, something perhaps on the order of 2%. And to the extent that that would be the basis for a compound annual 2% increase in spending and in sales revenues, in the absence of other elements, it would be tending to add 2% to the nominal rate of profit. It would be making the nominal rate of profit 2% greater than it otherwise would have been. And if at the same time production and supply were going up 2%, the real rate of profit would be 2% higher. What if production and supply were going up 3% or 4% while money and spending went up 2%? Then prices would fall, and what would be implied about the real rate of profit? If here you are, you're making a 2% nominal rate, and but when you have your extra 2% in money, prices are now 1 or 2% lower than they were the year before. Then your real rate would be that much higher. To the extent that we would have increases in production and supply surpassing the increase in money and spending, prices would fall, and the real rate of profit would be greater than the nominal rate. Now, what has been true in our actual circumstances, if not with respect to the rate of profit, at least with respect to short-term interest rates in the last few years? Well, we've had a federal funds rate that just got to 2% last week. It was 1.75 for some months before, and I think at the very beginning of the year it was as low as 1%. Meanwhile, what's happened to prices? Prices have risen, haven't they?
Yeah.
Even by the official statistics, they've risen on the order of, I think, 2.5% or 2.6%, something like that. So anyone who's been holding short-term treasury securities, what's been their situation? Well, do they have a positive real rate of return?
No.
No, they have a negative real rate of return because the rise in prices is great enough to use up their whole nominal rate of return. And what if you've held longer-term treasury securities, paying a munificent 4% perhaps, and on which, if you're in the upper brackets, you might be paying 1.6 or close to 2% even away in taxes, and prices have risen more than what you're left with. Well, that's a negative real rate of return too. Okay, well, as I say, what we want to explain, what our main focus is on, at least for the time being, is explaining the nominal rate of profit. And we already are partway into that, because we can see that one element working on the nominal rate of profit is simply the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. Now, what kind of nominal rate of profit does this imply you'd expect to exist in an economy without a gold standard? In an economy in which the government is able to increase the quantity of money and pump up the volume of spending as much as it likes.
Profits are artificially inflated.
You tend to have a higher rate of profit, and in the longer run, a higher rate of interest than otherwise. And I think you can observe this if you've traveled to a variety of different countries. I think you could easily correlate the severity of their inflation problems with the height of the nominal rate of profit and interest in those countries. Does anyone know what the nominal rate of profit and interest is currently in places like Brazil or Argentina? Well, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, it might be on the order of 20% or so. And not many years ago, when they had worse inflation, it was on the order of 80 or 90%. And you could be getting an 80 or 90% interest rate, but what good does that do you if prices are rising 100%?
Negative.
So it's a very negative relationship. Okay, so here we are. We have the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending tending to add at least an approximately equivalent number of percentage points to the nominal rate of profit. And what I'm saying is, if the quantity of money and volume of spending in the economy were increasing at a compound annual rate of 2% a year, we should expect that there would be an addition of approximately 2 percentage points to the economy-wide average nominal rate of profit. If the quantity of money and volume of spending were increasing at a compound annual rate of 5% a year, we should expect that there should be an approximately 5% increase in the nominal rate of profit. Not 5% increase, the addition of 5 percentage points to the nominal rate of profit. So if the nominal rate of profit might otherwise have been 4%, now it would be 9%. If the money and spending increase were 2% and the rate of profit were otherwise 4%, now it would be 6%. The increase in money and spending is tending to add an approximately equal percentage to what the nominal rate of profit would otherwise have been, an equivalent number of percentage points. Now, does anyone have any problem with this connection between the increase in money and spending and the addition to profits? Does it not seem intuitively true to anyone? Does anyone think it seems intuitively false? Is it counterintuitive? I mean, after all, the essence of profit is you're buying today to sell for more tomorrow. You're buying now in order to make sales for larger sums in the future. Well, what's going to be a huge influence on the size of the sales the average seller can expect to take in, if not how much money is out there underpinning sales at that future point in time? Yes, Mr. Lamb.
My apology. Can you just go back to that previous bullet point, a note you made? Excuse me, I think it was what drove prices down. If production increases more rapidly than
the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. To the extent that production and supply increase more rapidly than money and spending. And you can think of this in terms of that price level formula that we introduced on the first class session. The general consumer price level is equal to the aggregate demand for consumers' goods, that is the amount of spending to buy them, divided by the quantity produced and sold. So if you just work with that formula, plug the percentage increase in money and spending into the numerator, and the percentage increase in production and supply in the denominator, then you have the percentage change in prices.
Gotcha.
Okay. Well, we can accept the increase in money and spending as a as a very important factor in explaining an overall economy-wide aggregate nominal rate of profit. That is one element of the explanation. But I don't think it's especially satisfying to base the rate of profit in its entirety on simply the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. So we need to look for some other factors. We need to find other factors that will help explain the economy-wide rate of profit, and so that it is not purely and simply a phenomenon of the increase in the quantity of money. Now, what do we have to do to go about finding any other factors determining the economy-wide amount and rate of profit, apart from the increase in the quantity of money? Let's say here we are, we admit the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending that it brings about. That is definitely a contributing element to the economy-wide average rate of profit. We grant that. But now we want to find out what, if anything else, is present to explain the economy-wide profits. So what do we have to do to get on the trail of anything else that might be present?
Should start with increased productive expenditure altogether. If you look at increased productive expenditures, you also have to look at the component of increased wages or labor. Labor, in turn, has increased consumption.
Well, but you see, that's the increase in productive expenditure. If we're back to the increase in productive expenditure, what is required to make that possible as a continuing phenomenon?
Increased savings.
Simply increased savings or what?
Investment.
Pardon me?
It's a volume increase.
An increase in the quantity of money. So, suppose we had the same quantity of money, but people have decided to save more. Well, that would be possible. So now they'd be spending less for consumers' goods and spending more for capital goods. Would that represent more spending in total?
No.
No, it could bring about a larger production and supply of goods, but it wouldn't be more spending. In order to have more spending in the economy as a whole, what must we have, at least over a period of time? An additional quantity of money. All right, but we're looking for things that can explain profit other than the increase in the quantity of money and the increase in the volume of spending. So what would we have to do to at least have a hope of finding such things? If we grant the influence of more money in spending. Now we're looking for other things. Well, what must be our procedure from this point on until we can find some other things with respect to money and its increase?
Don't we have to have a more of a demand? If I have all the money in the world and I have to have a product, you know, I have to desire
Well, people desire the products. We can grant that.
I can desire it. I can either have a manufacturer. I can go out and find somebody and say, this is what I want. Go make it and I'll buy it.
Okay, let's grant that. But we're interested in explaining how it is that the sales revenues in the economy will regularly and consistently exceed the costs apart from the contribution of more money and spending. Yes?
So you're asking how to increase the rate of profit?
We're asking what would enable it, what would make possible a positive rate of profit apart from the increase in money and spending.
Would it just be more efficiency and
productivity?
Well, say we have more efficiency, more productivity.
And that would lower the prices of products, which would generate more sales.
Well, that would lower the prices of products, but you'd have a larger physical quantity sold, but would it generate more spending to buy the products? We have the same quantity of money and the same volume of spending. Whatever increases in efficiency we have, whatever improvements in productivity, that will mean a bigger supply of products, but the larger supply would still have to be sold for the same volume of spending. You'd have lower prices. You'd be adding to the real rate of profit. The real rate of profit would be boosted, but what about the nominal rate? If we're selling a bigger quantity of goods for the same amount of dollars, how are we getting a bigger dollar profit?
lower production costs?
Well, you have a larger volume of sales. Our unit costs can be lower, but our, you said lower production costs. Well, if we produce twice the volume for the same outlays of money, what's implied about our unit costs?
Lower.
They're halved, right? But if we have to sell twice the volume of output for the same sales proceeds, what's implied about the prices? The prices would be halved too. Is there a profit? How do you get a profit out of the same dollar amount of sales revenues and the same dollar amount of costs? How do you get a bigger profit?
Is it the net consumption, like the something over product?
Okay, you're jumping ahead to an actual part of the answer. Ms. Yang is referring to net consumption. Well, we'll get there. But in order to get to such a thing, the first thing we would have to do is we have to agree to put the quantity of money and the volume of spending on the side, in the sense that we will hereafter proceed as though they are indefinitely fixed. We assume now that the quantity of money and the volume of spending are frozen. Why do we need to assume that they're frozen?
Because of that aspect of profit.
Because we're looking for what else could explain profit besides the increase in money and spending. And as soon as our task becomes look for something other than the increase in money and spending, well, how do we go about doing that? We have to take money and spending as frozen. So we don't have any increase in money and spending anymore. There's no increase in money and spending. And we're looking for a source of aggregate profit apart from the increase in money and spending. That's why we need the assumption of invariable money. The need for the assumption of an invariable money is in order to identify what is determining the rate of profit apart from the increase in money and spending. That's why we need the assumption of invariable money. All right, well, let's start looking. Now, there is something that can explain profits. Even if the only source of sales revenues in the economy were productive expenditure, even if that were the sole exclusive source of sales revenues, you could still explain an aggregate profit existing for a very, very considerable period of time, perhaps almost indefinitely. And this results from the fact that productive expenditure and costs, while they are related, they are not the same. The productive expenditure for plant and equipment shows up in the future as cost. It shows up over a period of years as depreciation cost. It doesn't show up in the moment the productive expenditure is made. The productive expenditure for inventory and work in progress, that shows up as cost when? When the goods are sold. When the goods are sold. So there's a time lag. Yes, Mr. Woody.
Oh, go ahead.
It is entirely possible that we could have productive expenditure in some given frozen amount, such as 1,000 units of money per year, but for a more or less indefinite time, costs could be less than that. And let's just see how this could be. Suppose we look first at an individual firm. Suppose an individual firm is spending $1 million per year buying new computers, and it will depreciate the computers over a three-year life. And let's imagine they buy their computers in the first quarter of each year. So here we are in the first quarter of 2005, they're going to spend $1 million for computers. All right, how will this $1 million outlay for computers show up in their income statement at the close of 2005? What's going to be the income statement item that will derive from the $1 million outlay for computers in the first quarter of 2005?
Depreciation.
It'll be a depreciation charge of $333,333, right? All right, now, in that year, the firm's productive expenditure was $1 million. Its costs were only $333,333, right? The costs were substantially below the productive expenditure. Well, now, that $1 million of productive expenditure for that firm, that's $1 million of sales revenue to the sellers of the computers, right?
Right.
Okay. And now, the sellers of the computers, they're making productive expenditures in the year too, also in the year. And suppose they've made productive expenditures of $1 million, and their productive expenditures of $1 million happen to show up as the sales revenues of our firm that's bought the computers. Okay, well, what could we expect so far? If we aggregate all of the sales revenues and all of the costs, couldn't we, pardon me?
Isn't it the 1 million and then add the 33?
Well, even if the computer firm had costs equal to its million, let's assume that. Suppose they had costs equal to their million. What are the total sales revenues we've counted up here between these two firms?
$2 million.
$2 million. And what would be the total cost we've counted so far?
$600.
Well, I'm hearing different numbers.
You don't know what the computer firm...
Well, we'll say, imagine their costs equal to $1 million.
Well,
okay. Then the total cost would be 1.33, right? $1,333,000. So here we are, we'd have sales revenues of $2 million in the economy, and we'd have total costs of substantially less than that. And we'd have, you see, here we are, the productive expenditure generates sales revenues equal to itself, but costs may be less than productive expenditure, at least for some time. And to the extent that they are, those same costs are less than sales revenues. To the extent that costs are less than productive expenditure, they will also be less than the sales revenues that the productive expenditure generates. So suppose I tell you we have an economy, in the whole economy, sales revenues are 1,000. Productive expenditure in that whole economy is also 1,000. Would it be possible that costs in that economy could be 900? Would there be anything that would allow costs in that economy, at least for that year, only to be 900. So what would have to be going on? We have productive expenditure of 1,000. The productive expenditure generates sales revenues of 1,000, but the costs are only 900. Well, suppose of this 1,000 of productive expenditure, some part were for durable plant and equipment, and that plant and equipment has depreciation that is less than that productive expenditure. Or suppose also they're buying inventory and work in progress, but their cost of goods sold is less than their expenditures on account of inventory and work in progress. Let's look at it this way. Let's take an example like sit and sleep. You know, the guy who's telling you it's free. Yeah, Larry who deserves to be killed. All right, sit and sleep has sales of $1 million. And if their productive expenditure, if their costs were equal, well then their costs would be $1 million. Would it be possible to imagine that in a given year, sit and sleep pays out $1 million buying merchandise, paying its employees, its lighting and heating bill, its advertising, whatever else they have to do. So it has $1 million of productive expenditure, but some substantial part of this productive expenditure is for new mattresses or whatever. And let's say out of its $1 million of productive expenditure, they've spent $600,000 for new mattresses from the mattress manufacturers. And then in the course of this year, their cost of goods sold in terms of the mattresses that leave their premises and warehouse, their cost of goods sold is not $600,000, not their productive expenditure, not equal to their productive expenditure to buy mattresses, but it's less. It's only $500,000. Is that imaginable?
Yep.
Okay. So here we are, they've expended $1 million and their sales revenues are only $1 million. Can they have a profit? They can have a profit which will show up in an increase in their inventory. in the fact that they have acquired 100,000 of inventory that they haven't sold, and that on which cost of goods sold has not appeared. Yes, Mr. Wright.
I heard Lloyd say something interesting. What about debt financing? For example, let's say they borrow $1 million to buy $1 million for the mattresses, but the payment in that first year is only $10,000. So in theory, they have a lot more.
Actually, that's a different aspect. I was thinking customers, like,
well, the customers
deferring financing, like I think he was thinking about, so that actually he wouldn't receive any revenues for a year or two or however many there.
Well, the customers, when they get the revenues right away, not from the customer, but from
a
lender.
Finance,
yeah, okay. So what is your question again? They borrow, if they borrow, if you get into borrowing, that doesn't change anything fundamental. That just means there are funds available in other firms that instead of those other firms productively expending them, they lend them, and now this firm productively expends them.
But it's not showing up on the
That wouldn't be a factor adding to total spending or anything like that. Yes, Mr. Foster.
What if the productive expenditure for this inventory, let's say, would extend beyond a period of a year to actually produce? I know mattresses don't take that long to make.
Okay.
If they work.
Okay.
How would that affect, would that fall into line with what you were proposing?
If they extended beyond a year?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good question. Let's deal with this kind of inventory case. Suppose we have the aged whiskey industry, and they're turning out 8-year-old scotch. Now, when they're starting up, or if they're expanding, anytime they're initiating, they have to make outlays for raw whiskey, right? Okay, now, before that outlay is going to show up as a cost of goods sold, it has to sit there and ferment for 8 years, right? Okay, but the outlays they make are sales revenues today, right? Okay, so here we are. We have sales revenues somewhere in the economy equal to those productive expenditures. But do those productive expenditures have a present counterpart in costs on the part of the people making them?
Defer the cost over a year.
The cost, it's not going to show up as a cost for 8 years, right? And then in year two, they're doing the same thing. So in this case, they could go on making these productive expenditures for 8 years, in which there'd be 8 years of equivalent sales revenues, but only in year eight and thereafter would there be equivalent costs. So for that 8-year interval, we'd have sales revenues, even though they're equal to productive expenditure, still exceeding costs, because the costs corresponding to the productive expenditure would be deferred for 8 years. Yes, Mr. Boisson.
You're allowed to defer the cost for materials and labor for 8 years when you're doing that?
Yes, if the product takes 8 years before you can sell it, that would be cost of goods sold.
But it would show up as some type of like accrual or something?
Well, yeah, it would show up on your balance sheet. On your balance sheet, you have the... your work in progress would be the outlay for year one, and then you'd add the outlay for year two, year three, up through eight, and by the end of 8 years, you'd have an inventory of scotch in different stages of readiness that would reflect the sum of 8 years' outlays, and then starting either in year eight or year nine, you finally begin selling. So from that point on, your cost of goods sold would equal your current outlay. You'd have a cost of goods sold in year nine or year eight, reflecting your outlay in year one for the 8-year-old whiskey. Now, notice we can tie this back to the increase in money and spending again. If over the course of 8 years, the quantity of money and volume of spending are growing, what should we expect to be happening to the outlays of the makers of 8-year-old scotch from year to year? They should be growing too. And notice by the time they sold the scotch that had been aging for 8 years, there'd be a compounding factor in the sales revenues reflecting 8 years' growth. So that would be adding to their profits over this time. Okay, but we're ignoring the increase in money and spending. Here we are. We have, we're seeing that you could have an aggregate profit with the same frozen volume of productive expenditure and sales revenues equal just to productive expenditure. You could have it to the extent that costs are less than productive expenditure. Now, to that extent, when we have productive expenditure exceeding costs, what phenomenon have we identified as present? You have to think back a couple of weeks when we were discussing national income accounting.
Can you repeat the question, please?
What is the difference between productive expenditure and costs? Productive expenditure minus costs equals what?
Net investment.
Net investment. Now notice, net investment worked out to be productive expenditure minus costs, right? Net investment is productive expenditure minus costs. Now, that same productive expenditure generates equivalent sales revenues. And it's those same costs that are deducted from sales revenues in calculating profits. Well, the implication is, to whatever extent we have net investment in the economy, we should have a virtual dollar-for-dollar equivalent in aggregate profit. To whatever extent we have an economy-wide net investment, productive expenditure exceeding costs, we should have a corresponding aggregate profit. So you just think for a moment. Suppose we have 1,000 of productive expenditure. Let's say, well, I actually have an example here. Let's perhaps turn to that. Okay, this is on the last page of the supplement. I say, productive expenditure for buildings and equipment by business is 1,000. This is in the economy as a whole. So it's 1,000 units of money. Each unit could be many billions or tens of billions of dollars. So productive expenditure for buildings and equipment, these are newly produced buildings and equipment, is 1,000, while total annual depreciation charges are 820. And productive expenditure for labor, materials, and supplies is 2,000, while cost of goods sold is 1980. Find net investment. Yes, Mr. Barton?
20.
Yeah, Mr. Barton says 20. 20 is net investment in what? Why do you say 20?
2,000. It's cost of goods sold.
Okay.
And then 1980.
1980 is cost of goods sold.
Okay.
All right, 2,000 is productive expenditure for.
No, it's a negative 20. No. 20%.
Well, 20, I would say 20 is part of net investment. Net investment in what? If 2,000 is being expended for labor, materials, and supplies, what's the accounting treatment of that 2,000? Where does it go? Here you are. Pardon me?
You said net investment, right?
It's net investment in what? I notice I'm missing a comma here. It would be net investment in inventory. Net investment in inventory and work in progress would be 20. And then we have another component of net investment, which is what?
820 minus the 180.
180, the 1,000 expenditure for plant and equipment minus the 820 of depreciation. That 1,000 is being added to what in the balance sheets? To gross plant and equipment. There's 1,000 added on to gross plant and equipment. Now, if there were no depreciation at all, if there were no current depreciation, what would be the effect of 1,000 more of gross plant on net plant?
If there was no depreciation?
If there were no current depreciation, then net plant would go up by 1,000 too. But we're also adding 820. We have 820 of depreciation. And where does that enter into the balance sheet? In the accumulated depreciation reserve, which is subtracted from gross plant. So here we are, we have 1,000 added to gross plant, which as far as it goes is working to add 1,000 to net plant, but we have 820 added to accumulated depreciation, which is reducing net plant by 820. So what's the change in net plant? 120. Net plant goes up by 120. 180, I'm sorry, 180. So that is net investment in plant. We have 180 of net investment in plant. We have 20 of net investment in inventory. So net investment altogether is 200. Now, if sales revenues equal productive expenditure, well, what are sales revenues? I ask you, find total business sales revenue from the above data on the assumption that all wages have a counterpart in consumption expenditure. So whatever wages are, there's going to be that much consumption expenditure. What would total sales revenues be here?
3,000.
Yes?
3,000.
3,000. Why would total sales revenues be 3,000?
Because 2,000 you're spending plus the 1,000 plus 2,000.
There's 1,000 plus 2,000. Now we know that much of these 3,000 will be expenditure for products, right? That's sales revenues. What isn't an expenditure in buying products or services from businesses, that's wage payments. And we're assuming that all the wages have a counterpart in consumption. So if that's true, then the sales revenues equal 3,000. So if sales revenues equal 3,000, or that's the answer to B, now you're asked, find aggregate profit in the economic system on the assumption net consumption is zero. Many of you may not know what that refers to, but just ignore it then. And thus that sales revenues equal productive expenditure alone. So sales revenues are equal to productive expenditure alone. And now you're asked, find aggregate profit.
The same as net investment.
The same as net investment. Because what are the costs that we have?
Cost of goods sold.
We have depreciation and cost of goods sold, and they add up to 2,800, right? So aggregate profit is 200 equal to net investment. And this isn't accidental. Net investment is the difference between two things, productive expenditure and costs. The productive expenditure shows up in sales revenues, and the costs are the same costs that we deduct from sales revenues in arriving at profit. Okay, so so long as there is net investment, we can have an aggregate profit, even though productive expenditure is constant and it's the only source of sales revenues. But we are not out of the woods yet. We're not out of the woods. Suppose here we are. We have sales revenues in the economy. We'll go back to the number 1,000. Sales revenues are 1,000. Productive expenditure is 1,000. And so far, all we have is costs are 900. But what is bound to happen if year in and year out productive expenditure continues to be 1,000? You see, what allows cost to be less than productive expenditure is that we're depreciating assets. And we gave the example of the computers. Let's rework the computer example. We have a firm that's spending $1 million for new computers in the first quarter of each year, and this coming year, 2005, is the first year that it's going to do this. Well, in 2005, it has $1 million of expenditure for computers, but its depreciation cost is only what? $333. All right. But what happens when we get to 2006 and it has a second million of expenditure for new computers? What will its depreciation charge in 2006 be? $666.66. Notice what's happened to the magnitude of its net investment. It's gone down. Now, what will happen when we get to 2007?
It'll be $133 less.
Well, in 2007, what will be their annual depreciation now on 3 years' worth of computers? It'll be $1 million. It's actually not 333.333. It's 333.33. Yeah. So it's $999.99. Actually, it's $1 million. So notice, if they continue buying assets with the same depreciable life, what's happening to net investment?
It's
if they keep spending just the same sum of money, like $1 million year in and year out, what's happening to depreciation? Well, depreciation catches up to productive expenditure.
Right.
If you repeat the same volume of productive expenditure year in and year out for assets of the same life, then it's only a question of time before depreciation will get up to, will get to equilibrium. Well, and you have a similar issue with inventory. You can have cost of goods sold less than your productive expenditure, but what would be implied if you had constant sales revenues, so long as your cost of goods sold is less than the productive expenditure and you have net investment in inventory, what is implied about the ratio of inventory to sales?
Can you say that again?
What's implied about the ratio of inventory to sales if we have an unchanged volume of sales in dollars, we have fixed dollar sales revenues, and we had continuing net investment in inventory? What would be increasing? We'd have a rising ratio of inventory to sales. Now that's possible for a time, but do you think that this is likely to continue indefinitely?
No.
What will happen at some point? There'll be some kind of clearance effort. You'll have a clearance sale, and when you do, you're going to move more goods, right, when you have the clearance sale. What's the effect of that on cost of goods sold? It will go up. So now, if we build in an assumption that somewhere along the line we're going to have to reach stability in the ratio of inventory to sales, that will mean that a net investment in inventory has to stop. And at that point, what's the relationship between cost of goods sold and the productive expenditure to acquire inventory and work in progress? Well, the cost of goods sold will come up to the level of the productive expenditure. That will stop further inventory accumulation. That puts an end to the further net investment in inventory and means we'll now have a stable ratio of inventory to sales. So net investment in inventory tends to come to an end. So I think we can see some kind of tendency here where if we had an invariable money and we had the same volume of spending, the same volume of productive spending year in and year out, giving rise to the same volume of sales year in and year out, ultimately there'd be a very powerful tendency for costs to catch up to productive expenditure and thus to sales revenue and wipe out profit. Now, this could be postponed for quite a time, and let's consider the sorts of things that would be needed to postpone it. We dealt with a case, you're buying a depreciable asset of 3 years, the computers. Well, in 3 years, the depreciation on those assets will equal any constant level of productive expenditure for them. What if there could be some shifting of funds from assets with a shorter depreciable life to assets with a longer depreciable life? How would that affect things? Well, what's the effect on current depreciation to the extent that any given size sum could be shifted from assets with a shorter depreciable life to assets with a longer depreciable life? So imagine we could shift $1 million away from these 3-year computers to some asset with a life of 10 years. Well, now here we are. We have depreciation on the computers, but that's going to diminish as the computers are fully depreciated. If we're not spending any new funds on computers, what would be the depreciation in the fourth year? If we're not spending anything for computers in year four, well, then we'd only have 2 years of computers to expense. In year five, we'd have only 1 year left. In year six, there's no further current depreciation for computers. And now, if meanwhile, the $1 million outlay is for assets with a 10-year life, what will be the annual depreciation on an asset with a 10-year life? $100,000, not $333,000. So how long could we go on before annual depreciation got up? It would be 10 years, right? Okay. And then if we could go from there to 25-year assets and so on, we could prolong it still further. All right, now, there are other things that could occur as well. Take something like the construction of a skyscraper. It has a very, not just a long depreciable life, but it has a fairly considerable construction period. Now, when you're constructing a skyscraper or a very large factory with a, that's complicated, in the period of construction, substantial outlays are being made. There's substantial productive expenditures to pay the salaries of the construction workers, to buy the construction materials, to rent the construction equipment. And all of these outlays are sales revenues, right? They're sales revenues to the sellers of the products. They enable the wage earners to go and buy consumers' goods. So these productive expenditures are generating sales revenues. But while the construction is going on, what costs are showing up in the income statement of those making the expenditures? Pardon me? Well, they're making expenditures, but what costs would there be in the income statement of those making the expenditures?
Throughout the years of the life of the building of the skyscraper.
Yeah, while the skyscraper is being constructed, what would be would there be costs showing up in the income statements of those doing the construction, the firms doing the construction?
Yes.
Well, would the wages of construction workers be an expense item, or would it be part of the value of the building being constructed? It's part of the value of the building. And those wages will only show up later on when the building finally starts to get depreciated. They'll show up as cost only over the life of the building. And the same is true of the construction materials. You see, you wouldn't have much of an asset for a building if you're expensing all of the expenditures. And what would be implied about the income statements of the firms doing construction? What would that look like? They'd have horrendous losses just because they're putting up a building. So that isn't an expense. That's debited into the gross plant and building account. All right, now, to the extent that new major structures are being built, this means that you have a period where there are very substantial expenditures generating equivalent sales revenues, but there are no equivalent costs. You have a net investment, and in the economy as a whole, it's going to be the case that there will be equivalent profits in the economy as a whole. And there are some projects of very considerable duration, like think, for example, of the Channel Tunnel. Mm-hmm. How long did that take before it started incurring any depreciation? I think it had a construction period of maybe 10 years. So there are possible substantial construction periods. Now, and then there are different products with different cycles. Like, it's one thing to turn out many common types of goods. It's a different thing to turn out 8-year-old scotch. What would be the effect to the extent that the whiskey industry started shifting from 8-year-old scotch to 12-year-old scotch, or from 12 to 20 or 30-year-old scotch? Then you have a longer lag, and it's within this longer interval of time that productive expenditure can continue to surpass costs. Well, now, to add all of this stuff up, there are the following kinds of possibilities for an aggregate profit being maintained on the foundation of net investment. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
Am I way off by saying that you're saying that in the case of the scotch, not recognizing the cost of the scotch until the actual revenues are
Until it's sold. You see, the cost, the concept cost of goods sold means literally that it's the cost of the goods that are sold. Now, until the goods are sold, the money expended to produce them is treated as residing in the value of the asset in the inventory. Pardon me?
As like work in progress.
As work in progress or inventory, depending on whether it's finished or not. Mr. Taylor, you're welcome.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to repeat the last thing you made when you said the longer, or that you were coming to the point that the longer the time that the productive expenditure surpasses the cost, then the greater the...
Well, I'm just simply saying that so long as products, the production of products can be expanded with a longer production time, like 12-year-old scotch versus 8-year-old, 20 versus 12, or any kinds of products. Different products have different production periods in terms of the length of the time it takes to go through work in process, the time the inventory has to stay with you. And to whatever extent there was any movement from products with a shorter such cycle to products of a longer cycle, that would maintain that investment. To whatever extent plant and equipment, we shifted to plant and equipment with a longer depreciable life rather than a shorter. To whatever extent projects were undertaken with a longer construction period. And also, to whatever extent productive expenditures could be shifted away from selling general and administrative expenses into inventory, into longer lived inventory, or into plant and equipment, or longer live plant and equipment. These are all of the kinds of things that could keep some net investment in being for some more or less considerable time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So practically speaking, then, in terms of business action, in terms of what you do in business, so this is why you see the strategy of capitalizing a software program, right? Where you're going to do a software development, and you use a strategy of capitalizing that development over a 3-year period, because as it pertains to, you look at the income statement, then it's going to show a higher level of profit over the next 3 years, as opposed to if you just, you know, bought that.
Start selling it.
Right.
Pardon me?
Start selling it, then you have to.
Yeah, but I say this proceeds, this is not so much an issue of business strategy, where if it gets to be an issue of business strategy, something not quite kosher may be going on. If you have, there are firms that are not doing too well, but if they could capitalize expenses, which perhaps should not be capitalized, that appear to be doing better.
Right.
So that it can get to be shady type accounting if it's abused. So there are actually sound principles of accounting that determine under what circumstances it's appropriate to capitalize expenditures. It's not really a matter of business strategy. It's the nature of business accounting. If you start thinking of it as a strategy issue,
you're right. Yeah, okay.
By me?
As long as you use a business strategy under, you know, a legal approach.
Okay.
Fine, right?
All right. Yeah. Stick to generally accepted accounting principles. Okay. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
Professor, how do you then recognize expenditures or report expenditures whereas a company, instead of selling its goods, actually leases its goods over a period of time?
Okay, well then the issue is the lease revenues. That would be their sales revenues.
The lease, like large copiers.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if a firm, to the extent that it's taking out the leases, that's the same as paying rent. That's its productive expenditure, and it's the lease revenue of the seller. And to the extent that it leases its own output, perhaps, then instead of having a sales revenue, it has some kind of rental or lease revenue.
But would the expenditures actually be broken up to the percentage of monthly payments that are made to that company? For example, if it's a $100 lease payment on a, you know, $1,000 copy, or that's 10%, would then 10% of all the expenditures be recorded as such over 10 years?
Well, it would depend on the example. Let's take a case. Someone owns a building, let's say an apartment building, and he's renting the units. All right, his revenue would be his rents taken in over the year, and that wouldn't affect his depreciation. He has a building that he's paid such and so much for, and it has a certain depreciable life, and that will govern his depreciation. And I assume it would be the same if you're renting, if you own copiers and you're renting their use or whatever, or Hertz rents automobiles, their sales revenue is their automobile rentals, and they have to depreciate their cars, and that's how they proceed. The fact that something is rented or leased, I don't think is a relevant consideration here. It works out the same way. Okay, now, so as I say, you could have a positive aggregate profit sustained for a more or less considerable time, maybe an indefinitely long time, on the foundation of net investment. But even so, the implication would be present that the economy-wide average rate of profit would have to be declining. Why would it be impossible to avoid a declining average rate of profit if the only thing that were present to sustain it were net investment? Well, let's look at it this way. Suppose we start off, the existing capital in the economy is 2,000 monetary units. Let's say that's the total value of the invested capital. And we have 100 of net investment being earned. We have 1,000 of sales revenues, 900 of costs, there's 100 of net investment. Okay, that's 100 of profit, and what rate of profit is implied on the capital in existence at the beginning of the year? 2,000. Pardon me? Yeah, we have 100 of profit based on 100 of net investment. Okay, then the rate of profit opens at 5%. But now we have this 100 of net investment. How does that affect the opening capital of the following year?
You would minus the 100 off of the profit.
What is the capital if we started with 200 and then we invested an additional 100? Pardon me?
Increase.
How much is the total capital if we begin with 2,000 and we add 100?
2,100.
Now it's 2,100, right? Okay, well, what if net investment in the second year remained 100? What's implied about the rate of profit now? If it would be 100 over 2,100, that's somewhat less, right? All right, what would be required to maintain the same 5% rate of profit? What would have to happen? Pardon me?
5% increase in
net. Oh, you'd have to have net investment go to 105, right? But if we have unchanged sales revenues in the economy, if the sales revenues are 1,000, and now we need 105 of net investment, what's implied about aggregate costs? If we're going to have 105 of net investment, that means we have to have costs less than productive expenditure by 105.
Yeah.
So what would costs have to be if sales are 1,000 and they have to be, and productive expenditure is 1,000, and costs need to be 105 less, then how much are costs?
895.
So if somehow costs could be made to drop from 900 to 895, then the rate of profit could be maintained. Now, this would be conceivable if productive expenditure shifted to longer-lived capital goods, to longer-lived plant and equipment, 20-year-old scotch instead of 8-year-old, longer-lasting construction projects. If that sort of thing happened, we could have more net investment. But then where are we a year later? What would be total capital a year after? It's 2205 now, right? And what kind of profit would we need to maintain the same 5% rate on 2205? Well, we need that much more profit, 5% on this bigger volume. What's implied as to what would have to happen to costs at this point? They'd have to go down further, right? Now, obviously, this must stop somewhere. Certainly, by the time you'd get to so much capital that you'd have to have costs going below zero, it's not going to get that far. So the implication is there is a limit to the decline in costs. And that means that whenever that limit were reached, the rate of profit must necessarily be falling. And if, and almost certainly the costs would be tending to come back up rather than go down, I think the clear undeniable implication is that in these circumstances, even so long as the rate of profit might be maintained, it would be declining. So now we want to narrow our assignment to ourselves and see, can we find any element that would explain the existence of an aggregate profit and a positive economy-wide average rate of profit that at the same time would not be subject to any tendency toward fall, that would not be tending to fall. Can we find something that will explain a positive economy-wide average rate of profit that will not be tending to fall? Pardon me?
A gold standard?
Well, you see, if we bring in a gold standard, that still represents some increase in the quantity of money. We have to find it in the context of an invariable money. Is there anything within the context of an invariable money that can explain a positive rate of profit that does not tend to decline? We need to find something other than net investment to do that. Net investment can explain a positive rate of profit for a more or less considerable period, but
reduce wages.
Well, I'm hearing productivity, reduce wages. When you say reduce wages, what do you mean by reducing wages? Wage rates?
Right, wage rates were lower.
Well, now, do you mean the wage? What would be done with the money previously paid as wages?
Consumption expense
or capital goods.
Well, I suppose it was spent for capital goods. Imagine the payrolls fell, and money previously expended in meeting payrolls was shifted to buying more capital goods. Well, that might maintain net investment somewhat longer, because the capital goods might be, they show up as cost over the longer interval than most wage payments, but you still have the same problem. Now, what about productivity? Well, suppose you produce twice as much, but you sell it for the same money, and it has the same outlay to produce. How does that affect the monetary profit?
Why? If you produce twice as much?
If you produce twice as much, but you have the same dollar amount of sales revenues, you say have the same dollar amount of costs, there's no change, so that wouldn't do it. Okay, so we need to find something that will fill the bill, that will explain how it is that sales revenues can permanently exceed costs. Now, I think we can infer this much already. What we need is some explanation of how sales revenues can be greater than productive expenditure. How sales revenues can be greater than productive expenditure. If we can do that, then even if costs end up equaling productive expenditure, suppose costs get all the way up to productive expenditure, we'll still have a positive profit. We'll have profit equal to the extent to which sales revenues exceed productive expenditure. They'll also exceed costs equal to productive expenditure. We need to find some basis of explaining how it is that sales revenues are able regularly and consistently to exceed productive expenditure. If we can do that, we'll also be able to see how sales revenues regularly and consistently exceed costs that equal productive expenditure.
Do you have the answer?
Yeah. I have the answer. But I want to keep you in suspense. And so we'll take a break. And the next installment is after the break. Okay. Tune in next week. Don't miss it. Okay.
Tune in 20 minutes.
Just awful. Let's see. I'm doing 24. I'm so guilty.